This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Positive use of the concept of cynicism. We discussed previously that cynicism is a very dangerous middle, a very dangerous attribute, because one can destroy anything with cynicism. No matter how sacrosanct a thing might be, one little smirk, one little smile, one word out of place can destroy its value totally. But we discussed on Parshas Poro that cynicism is a means of reducing things which are over-exaggerated sometimes. When the thing looks to be over-exaggerated, if one just becomes a little bit cynical about it, one can reduce it to its true level, to its correct level. There's a great deal of difficulty in this whole thing. We've just learned some of the dinim of kibud av, honoring a father, Kibud Rav, honoring a Rebbe. It's possible, let's not say possible, one of the reasons for Kibud Rav, for honoring a Rebbe, as given by the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, in the 36th chapter of the third section, is he says that if there is not this Kibud, if one doesn't create this aura of specialness around the Rebbe, his words won't be listened to. People won't take him seriously. That's a strange thing coming from the Rambam. But that's what the Rambam says. The part of the reason for Kovod Rav is in order to ensure that he remains effective in the community. Because if people see that a big fuss is made out of somebody and they honor him and they respect him, and that somebody says you mustn't do this or you should do that, people take it seriously. But if he's just somebody that they ignore and they stamp all over him, and he says you should do this, you shouldn't do that, it doesn't mean a thing, it has no value. That's one of the reasons for Kovod Rav. One can go so far as to say that on the one hand, by correct packaging, as they're now discovering in America, you can sell the public anything. You can take the biggest idiot and you can put him in the White House. It's possible to do such a thing. By selling him properly, by creating the right kind of aura around him, don't let him talk too much, don't let him come into too close a contact with the public, keep him a little bit shielded from the public, and prepare his statements very well, and prepare his speeches very well, and dress him up the right way, and put on the right makeup, teach him how to move himself and how to bear himself, and you can get the fellow voted in. I'm beginning to worry the Americans that the qualities you need to be elected are not the same qualities as you need to govern. So one sees that with COVID, you can con the nation. So much so, in fact, that we're even told that in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, the Jews were actually Oved Avodah Zorah, whatever that means. We don't know exactly what it means. But they certainly got involved in this whole idolatry surrounding the land, around the sheep. We'll see still exactly where it stands. The Medrash says, for example, in Parshas Bo, you find among the Jews in Israel, when they were in Egypt, they used to serve idolatry and not leave it alone. What does that mean? They used to serve the sheep. They used to believe in some way, some minimal way. They don't understand exactly what that means. They didn't serve the sheep the way the Egyptians did. But they were somehow impressed with the powers of the lamb. And that's crazy. But by putting the lamb and putting the sheep into the special category, one can give it an aura of specialness which affects people. I'll never forget, I was a school kid and we went to Cape Town once on some kind of a tour and we were going around the castle. And there were quite a lot of people in the castle going around, and a friend of mine and myself stood at the telephone. It was just a regular telephone to see what would happen. And we stood there and looked at this phone and looked at this on the one side, and we stood there for about half an hour. Eventually somebody, a little crowd gathered, and people were trying to look at what we were admiring, and somebody tapped us on the shoulder and said, yes, what are you looking at? It was his phone. They looked at it. Silence around him. Everybody stood and looked at it. One lady there was taking notes even. That's what you can do. You can put a thing in a museum. It can be a very ordinary, simple thing. You can put it in a museum, and a nice glass case around it, and a fancy Latin or Greek name underneath it that nobody understands. And believe it or not, you'll get a crowd of people to come and admire it. It's possible. It's possible to con people with covers by giving something honor that is not due to it. It's possible to put it into a situation which where it doesn't deserve to belong altogether. So what will you do then? Open it to cynicism. Then even the greatest of things will become nothing. So where is this balancing line? There is a view that it's not true to say that since the Second World War we don't have any leaders anymore. We used to have a Churchill, used to have a Roosevelt, used to have Stalin even, you much know, but okay, he was a man of stature. A De Gaulle, somebody, who we got today? Nobody. All over the world, absolutely. Those leaders and the leaders of today are the fact that today we expose them to such heavy TV analysis. And every little, the fellow can have a black spot on his cheek and the whole world knows about it. And he can, every little thing is deviled out. He doesn't have a private life. He's exposed totally. And the view is that if you would have treated a Churchill or a Roosevelt or a Stalin or a De Gaulle or anybody to the same kind of TV scrutiny that we treat our leaders today, that we subject our leaders today, they wouldn't have survived either. There's such a view. And in fact, the Queen is praised as being a monarch who, despite close TV scrutiny, has managed to sort of stay where she is. Now, it's a bit of a joke what TV scrutiny is. Once a year they see her on TV, here and there in front of the movie, but they don't scrutinize her the way they do politicians. And who knows where she would be if they really scrutinized her. So what does one do? If one tries to reduce everybody to their common denominator, then you'll say that the candidate for the president, in terms of leadership, he doesn't have anything on Kennedy. In terms of managerial ability, he's nothing like Nixon. In terms of congressional stature, he's nothing like Johnson. So who is he? In each thing, one tries to bring him to his lowest common denominator, and you come to the conclusion he's like nobody. He's absolutely useless. Not like one of the presidents is he as good as any of them. The fact that in other ways, and as well as being very knowledgeable on high standards. And he said to me, "No, it says your amplifier is no good." I said, "Why is my amplifier no good?" He said, "It's only 20 watts per channel." I don't know what that means, but that's what he said. I said, "So how many watts per channel do I need?" He said, 70. 70 watts per channel, but I've been listening very nicely on 20. I'm improving it a bit now, but it hasn't been terrible on 20. It's absolutely useless. You need 70. So I said to him, "Look, whatever this means, watts per channel, I imagine it's got something to do with the power that goes through each loudspeaker. What will happen? When I'm listening to music, what am I usually listening to? How much? If in my old amplifier, I never heard more than 20. So my new amplifier, what am I going to be listening to? 25? 30? So I'll understand if you told me I need 30 watts per channel, 35 watts per channel. Where did you get 70 from?" So he said, "No, you don't understand." He says, "You'll very seldom be using 70 watts per channel. But just imagine you're listening to a piece of your favorite music, really brilliant orchestral music. And you're listening to it for one peak that you know appears in the third movement. And you listen to the first movement and the themes are introduced. And you listen to the second movement and the themes are developed there. And the music develops and develops and you come to the third movement, to your favorite movement, and it stops. And it builds up. And it builds up. And all the themes of the first movement are interplaying with one another. And all the themes of the second movement are being introduced into the first movement and new themes are being created. And it builds up. And the volume builds up. And it starts off just with the violin, and then the violins are joined by the cellos, and the cellos are joined by the trumpets, by the brass, and then comes the wood, and then comes the double basses, and you've got the whole orchestra, and they reach a crescendo, and the speaker stops. You might as well throw the whole record away. You can't listen to that music on a set that can't reach up to 70 watts a channel when it has to. You need that in reserve. So I bought it." But what that taught me is, when you're looking for a leader, you don't have to worry that much about his day-to-day ability of running the country. Because a country runs itself more or less. It has massive institutions, a massive civil service. Any fairly intelligent man can run the country. That's not the problem. Or run a community, or run a school, or run a business. Any form of leadership. Any fairly intelligent man with a fairly good managerial ability can run anything. No problem. you've got to worry about is, does he have the ability to get to the 70 watts on the rare occasions when you need it? But that's when you need a leader. That's when he's got to be there. And what are we doing when we're exposing them to TV? We're exposing them on a day-to-day basis, and we're saying, look at them, they're just ordinary individuals. Of course they're ordinary individuals. Who expects anything more from them? What one wants to know is, on the rare occasions when they really need to inspire the people, when they need to take charge, when they need to take major decisions, that's what we want to know, how they're going to perform. And how does one do it? If one exposes them to the polls, and every day you see 60% approve of them, the next day 50% approve of them, the next day 40% approve of them, if you're going to do that, that's going to ruin their ability to govern the country. If you're going to isolate them and put them in a palace and just keep them for those very special occasions, then we come to the old problem of packaging garbage and selling garbage to the community. Where do we find that middle line? And that's the subject of the shooting. Shabbos HaGodl is strange in several ways. Firstly, the strangest thing of all about Shabbos HaGodl is that we don't keep it on a specific date. The only day of the year that we don't keep on a date, not the 10th of Nisan, it's just the Shabbos before Pesach. That's it. The second thing that's funny, in other words, Shabbos HaGodl falls on a different date every year. The second thing that's funny is that there are no dinim involved with Shabbos HaGodl. There are no things you must do or may not do. It's just an ordinary Shabbos with a special name. That's all it is. According to some, you don't even read a special Haftorah today. You certainly don't read anything special from the Torah. And according to some, not even a special Haftorah. Nothing extra today, no special dinim, it's just Shabbos HaGodl, that's all. Shabbos HaGodl was a one-time experience. All the other Yomim Tovim took place, something took place in the past, and we're meant to do something every year to relive the experience. Shavuos is Matan Torah. Torah was given, and each year we've got to experience the receiving of the Torah. And Sukkot, each year we've got to feel that being in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam that we felt when we were really in the desert. Pesach, we've got to feel Yetzias Mitzrayim. Shabbos HaGodl took place once and never before, never again. The din was, the first time the Korban Pesach, the first time that the Pesach offering was brought, was in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. And that year, on the 10th of Nisan, which happened to be a Shabbos, they had to choose their lambs. And they had to keep it for 4 days. After that time, they did not have to choose their lambs before. They could choose their lambs the last minute as long as they were satisfied that the lambs were suitable for the korban. But that time and that time only, they had to take the lamb 10 days before, so 4 days before, on the 10th of Nisan, and then it says in the 6th pasuk of Shmot Yud Bet, chapter 12 in Shmot, V'hoya lachem lemishmeres, and it shall be to you for a mishmeres ad arba asa yon lachodesh azeh, until the 14th day of this month, when you shech. What's the mishmeres? What does it mean, the mishmeres? Mishmeres can mean one of two things. It can either mean, and you shall look after it for 4 days, or it could mean, with a bit of a stretch, and it shall look after you for 4 days. And strangely enough, that's how the Orach Chaim takes it. By the way, who's responsible for our human cross to do this? Nobody knows. Thank you. Yeah, beautiful. I've always needed it because there are Mephoshim here which aren't in the others, which I use a tremendous amount. Lovely. Says the Orach Chaim, V'hoya lachem lemishmeres, perush, that means, al derech she'omru zal, according to the way where Chazal said, the pasuk goy mikerev goy. It says, God saved a nation, a goy from within a nation. It uses the word goy, which is not the nicest way of describing a nation. And the Chazal asked, why one goy from another, as if there's almost an implication that we were goying at the time. One nation from another, but there was no difference between the Egyptians and us. Says the Chasei Chazal, Shayu Yisrael b'Mitzrayim sruchim tas b'chukei Avodah Zarah. That the Jews in Egypt were dirtied a little bit with the laws of Avodah Zarah. They were involved in some small way, as we learned in the Medrash. Certainly they weren't idol worshippers. And among them there were people who, without knowing, subconsciously, they started taking on practices of Avodah Zorah. They just picked it up from their society. The way they dressed, the way they ate, all sorts of other things that they did frequently. And therefore, he says, I won't go translating it word for word, therefore, he says to the Rachai, they were instructed to take the sheep, which was the Avodah Zorah, it was the god of the Egyptians, and to shech the sheep in front of them. And that's what it means, Vayolachem Lemishmeres Perish, that means, Bimakom Mitzvah Shmirat Avodah Zorah, instead of the mitzvah of keeping Avodah Zorah, if you think you're keeping Avodah Zorah, by practicing the laws of the Korban Pesach, you free yourselves of the laws of the of Avodah Zorah. In other words, they were so ingrained into treating the sheep with certain respect, just because, you know, if the whole society does, as we said, you can stand and look at a telephone, and if everybody's admiring the telephone, you'll start admiring the telephone a little bit, something you think is special about it, something rubs off. And they lived in a society where everybody admired the sheep and respected the sheep and nobody touched the sheep. Tremendous covet they showed to the sheep. And one was a little bit affected by it. Therefore, says the Torah, by involving yourself for these 4 days in the Korban Pesach, you will avoid any other type of relationship with the sheep which would not be good. And this Orach Chaim is based on a couple of Rambams in the Moreh Nevuchim, which are extremely difficult Rambams. We've spoken about some of them previously. And it's also based on a medrash which I'll read to you. B'shoah she'amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe. This is now a medrash in Bo, Parsha 16. When the Ribbono Shel Olam said to Moshe, Lishchos HaPosach, to shech the Korban Pesach, Omar le Moshe, Moshe said, Ribbono Olam, Hadobar Hazeh Eich Ani Yochel La'asot. How can I possibly shech the Korban Pesach? Don't you know that sheep are the gods of Egypt? Do you think it's possible that we can sacrifice the god of Egypt and they won't murder us, they won't stone us? Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu said the Ribbono Shel Olam to Moshe, Chayecho, by your life, Ein Yisrael Yotzin Mikan. The Jews are not going to get out of here. Ad sheyishchetu Eloyei Mitzrayim le'eneihem, until they shech the God of Egypt in front of their eyes, in front of the Egyptians' eyes. She'odia Elohim she'ein Elohei ha'atum klum. I'm going to prove to them that there's no value whatever in the gods of the idol worship. Again, there's an indication that the Jews were cons. The Jews, those clever people living in Mitzrayim, that clever land, were actually conned into believing that there's some kind of power attached to the sheep. What it is, maybe they didn't know. A god, maybe they didn't consider it. But God found it necessary to swear to Moshe that until they know for absolute sure that there is no power whatever in the sheep, they're not getting out of Mitzrayim. And the way they're going to do it is by shechting, by slaughter. The Rambam says in Moreh Nevuchim, in the 46th chapter of the third section, that that's the reason that they were told to take a sheep. That's the reason he almost implies of the Korban Pesach. Very difficult. If God had showed them that there's no power to the sheep, all he had to do was take one lamb and get Moshe Rabbeinu up on the platform in front of TV cameras and all the Egyptians and let him shech the lamb in front of everybody and show that nothing happened. That's all. What's the whole business? All the ritual. Everyone must take a lamb and they had to tie it to their beds for 4 days. And the lamb had to be perfect and it had to be 1 year old and it had to be just this and just that. And then they had to shech it and then they had to roast it in a particular way and they had to receive the blood and do with the blood according to the laws of the Korban Pesach. And on and on and on with ritual and ritual and ritual attached to this Korban Pesach. If this is only to show the Egyptians that there's no value and to show the Jews themselves that there's no godliness in a sheep, why don't you just check the sheep and that's it? That's the question that we have. The answer is incredible. answer is amazing. The answer is, to shech the lamb, you don't have to be very careful. To destroy something which somebody else holds precious is not very hard. It's easy. To be a cynic is no difficult. To take something which somebody else regards as special, justifiably or not justifiably, it makes no difference. You can take anything and you can bring it down to absolutely nothing. That was Viktor Frankl's whole criticism of modern schools of psychology. The system of man is nothing but, he called it. The man is nothing but theories. Everything, a sexual drive is nothing but this, and man is nothing but this, and intelligence is nothing but this. Everything is nothing but. You can reduce everything to nothing but. This building is nothing but a heap of sands and stones. That's what it is. This book is a piece of paper with some ink on it. It's nothing but a piece of paper with some ink on it. One can do the opposite of COVID. That's the opposite of COVID. We were learning this afternoon about COVID. Cynicism, reducing something to nothing but, is exactly the opposite of COVID. To take something down and bring it right up. I have an uncle who's an amazing cynic. And they live in Cape Town. They've been living in Cape Town for about 60 years. And they've never been to Stellenbosch. Stellenbosch is about 30 miles from Cape Town in a very beautiful town. And my aunt was very keen to come and visit us when we were in Stellenbosch. And when I was there with them once in Cape Town, I said, are you going to come one of these days? And she said to her husband, please, Heinke, I want to go to Stellenbosch. Stellenbosch? Why didn't you go to Stellenbosch? So knowing her husband, she didn't answer to go and see the Lappens because he would have said, they're here, you can see them. You didn't even see them, but she didn't say that. She said, they're such beautiful buildings. He says, in Cape Town, they're also beautiful buildings. She tried once more and she says, the oak trees. I want to see the oak trees. She says, come. Take her out onto the veranda. There's an oak tree. Now just imagine lots of those. That's Stellenbosch. Okay. You can do it with anything. You can take anything that's beautiful, anything that's special, anything that's holy, anything that's clever, and you can reduce it to absolutely nothing. That's the shoe we have on the potter. Take the golden calf and grind it up. It's just a bit of gold dust. That's all it is. But one can do it to the Beis HaMikdash Chas V'Shalom as well. You can take the Beis HaMikdash and grind it also up to a little bit of dust and say it's nothing but that. You can do it to anything. To shech the lamb, you don't have to be a prophet. I'll never understand the psychology of hunting. When hunters would hunt not for safety or for food, but for fun. You can't. You should. The animals must really think it's terribly funny. They go out. If they would say that the brilliance of hunting is in finding the lion. Okay. I can understand. You know the story that there was a fellow, Steinkirk, not the same Steinkirk, who went to India to hunt for lions, for tigers. Many of you might know the story. Comes back from India and he calls all his friends. He wants to show them the slides of his hunting trip. And he shows them this and he shows them that and he shows them the jungle and he shows them where he slept in the jungle and he shows them out on missions looking for tigers and he shows them running and he shows them shooting. He shows them everything. But she the friends say, how many tigers did you catch? Well, we did very well. He said, how many? Don't worry about us. We had a good time and we did very well. There's a time check. How many tigers? He says, well, tell you the truth, no tigers. Don't laugh. For tigers, that's a lot. Now, if that's the psychology of hunting, I understand it. But the chokhmah is to go and find the thing. Okay, but then you can go with a camera. You don't need a gun. If the chokhmah is to find it, so go with a camera and you can prove to everybody that you found the tiger. What do you say? The chokhmah is after you find it, shooting. That's the chokhmah. What's the chokhmah? Shoot an animal. There he is and you've got a gun and he hasn't and you shoot him and that's the chokhmah. It just doesn't make any sense. To shecht an animal is nothing. You can take Napoleon. You can take anybody you like. The greatest of the great. With a revolver, you can reduce him to nothing but a corpse. That's it. A dead, impotent, nothing. With one shot. You don't have to be particularly strong. You don't have to be clever. You just have to aim and pull the trigger and there's nothing there. To be a cynic, you don't have to be clever. The chiddush here is that even when it's idolatry that's involved, we're not allowed to do that. To mock what somebody else holds as special, we're not allowed to do that. That's What are we allowed to do? We're allowed to take the sheep and to hang on to it for 4 days. And this is why this was only done in Mitzrayim, because after this exercise, there were other reasons for the Korban Pesach. This reason no longer applies. What do we do during those 4 days? We make a tremendous patch of that land. Nothing's allowed to sit on it. Not a fly is allowed to go into it. We stand there, we watch it, we guard it. It's not allowed to work. We make sure that it's perfect. So you can imagine that if an Egyptian would have walked into a Jewish house, what would he have seen? A sheep tied to a bed in the bedroom, with a whole family on their hands and knees looking, inspecting the sheep, making sure that everything's in order. Someone swatting flies off the land. It would have looked the same as if they're serving the army. And they would have said to the Jews, "What are you doing?" And the Jews would have answered, "We're killing it in a few days' time. We're bringing it to the Korban." Can you imagine what went on there? Can you imagine what happened? But that's in order. That you can do, and that the Egyptian can tolerate. He's embarrassed by it, but he can tolerate it. Why? Because you're not saying to him, "A lamb, you worship a lamb, nothing. Don't be stupid." We don't say that at all. We say, "A lamb. Lamb's a very special animal. We take the lamb very, very seriously. We look after the lamb. What do you take it so seriously for? We bring it to the Korban." What are we doing in essence? What we're doing is trying to take the fake away. But everything requires Korban. There's nothing in the world which doesn't demand honor and respect. There's nothing which the Ribbono Shel Olam made, and after all he made everything, which doesn't demand dignity, respect, concern, covered. There's nothing in the world about which we can be cynical. There's nothing in the world about which we can be make less honest, joke about something or laugh about something, to belittle anything. Nothing in the world except avodah zarah, the service of an idol. But that's an action, not a thing which the Ribbono Shel Olam made. There's nothing which God made which we can mock. What we can do is find its true place. Find what it really is and slot it in where it really belongs. What's idolatry? Idolatry is not making something out of nothing. It's making something big out of something small. That's what idolatry is. What is arrogance? Making something big out of something small, not making something big out of nothing. We take the sheep and we say, "Listen, Egyptian, the sheep is a wonderful thing. The lamb is a very special animal. We have a very soft spot for lambs and we identify with it. We understand why you're so hitched on them and why you're so taken with them. But not to serve them, not as a god. We bring them as a korban. More than that, we study what a lamb really is. What is a lamb? We use a little bit of cynicism. But what are you? Remember in Parah Aduma we discussed, how do you grind the thing up? By using intellectual analysis. Just ask yourself, what is it? Right? What is a lamb? A lamb is a being that puts itself innocently in the hands of its shepherd. That's what a lamb is. Wherever the shepherd will lead it, that's where it will go. It doesn't ask questions. It hasn't the slightest sign of obstinacy. Always goes wherever the shepherd leads. So we Jews say, that's what a lamb is. That's what we are. We identify with the lamb as people, not as gods. On the contrary, the lamb isn't a god. How can you Egyptians regard the lamb as a god? The lamb we identify with as people, the lamb is like us. Hashem roi lo yechsar. God is my shepherd. I'm a sheep and I'm lacking nothing. That's the attitude of a lamb. One didn't have to bring a lamb for the Korban Pesach. One could bring a goat as well. And Hirsch points out very beautifully the difference between a lamb and a goat. Both, says Hirsch, give themselves up totally to their shepherd. But the lamb gives himself up to the whole community as well. He does whatever they do, not the goat. The goat is an individualist. He does his own thing. He won't take any nonsense from other goats. From his shepherd, he'll take anything. Wherever his shepherd sends him, he'll go. But he won't be pushed around by other goats. Or by other shepherds, only his own shepherd. And therefore, as Korban Pesach, we're allowed to bring either a lamb or a goat. There's place for both. You can be an individualist in Torah. You don't have to be pushed aside by, around by the community. Or you can be a communal person who just does what everybody does. That's also all right, as long as there's one condition. Shem roi loyas. The Ribbono Shel Olam is my shepherd. I don't have any other shepherd. He's the one who shows me where to go, and wherever he sends me, that's where I go. That's the principle of a lamb. That's the essence of a lamb. And we always talk about the fact that learning Torah means learning the essence, understanding what a thing really is. What is a lamb really? Take away the packing. Take away the glass case. Take him out of the museum. Don't become cynical, because if you become cynical, then a lamb is just a bit of flesh and bones. It's just some, what are those materials made of? It's just a bit of organic material. I don't know what elements go into flesh and bone, but that's all he is if you become cynical. But if you become analytical, to understand what he is in essence, then you understand the place of a lamb. The lamb is our giving ourselves up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The function of a lamb is as korban. So what do? By serving the lamb. And the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to teach the Jew and the Egyptian that there is no godliness in lamb. He doesn't teach them by telling them to shech the lamb. He teaches by telling them first to look after the lamb with great care and mishmeret, and then to bring it as a korban. You eat the lamb in kedusha, in taharo. It's prepared in a special way. It forms part of the seder service, the doros. It will always be part of the seder service. This is something very special. Here you have the essence of musr and of analysis. Yes, you've got to be critical. And yes, you've got to put things in glass cases. But putting things in a glass case is not the reason for your honoring. You mustn't admire a flower in a museum because it's in the museum. You must analyze what it is, admire it for what it is, and then put it in the museum so that nobody spoils it. You mustn't choose a leader because he's in a glass house. You must understand the leader, choose him because you admire him, and put him in the glass house so that cynics don't spoil him. And so it is with everything we do. First one has to understand the essence. What is this person really? Or what is this thing really in Metzius? And then you design the protective covering to make sure that he isn't harmed, that he isn't damaged. Or that a concept isn't harmed, that a concept isn't damaged. It's very easy to, in talking to other people, to tell them that what they believe in is nothing. Your religion is nothing. Your yeshiva is nothing. Your Rebbe is a nobody. It's very easy to tell them that. And one can tell them in quite a convincing way as well. It's easy to destroy. You're nothing. It's easy to tell a person. You're a nobody, a gornit. Who do you think you are? Anything? What do you know? You know anything? Have you learnt anything? Who are you? It's very easy to do that. Destroy people. That's cynicism. That's not what it's all about. If you want to give musr, then it's a question of just putting proportions there. Understanding that what you think you are is maybe not what you are. Perhaps you're more than what you think you are. Perhaps you're less than what you think you are. Study yourself and know who you really are. When one gives musa to oneself, one has to know, not that I'm a nobody, I'm a goyimit, I'm a nothing. Not at all. One has to simply see that I know who I really am and I put myself in the right slot. That's what's important. To shech the lamb is easy. To shech anybody's lamb is easy. Like hunting a lion. But the art would really be to fulfill the passage where it says, when man was created, he was instructed, you will rule over the animals. If a hunter will come back with a lion in a cage, that's clever. Yeah, he's mastered the beast. Okay, I understand. To take this idol, the lamb, and use it for avodas Hashem, that's destruction. That's how you destroy the Avodah Zarah, not just by wiping it out. You use it constructively, you use it for what it was meant. That's destroying Avodah Zarah properly. And so with all the other things that people might consider precious and are in fact exaggerated or distorted, don't destroy. Show them how to use it correctly. Show them where its true value lies, because everything, let's repeat, everything and everybody has a value which demands cover, has a value which demands respect, which demands honor. When one sees how people relate to things that they know demand honor, then one can be quite worried about how they relate to things which are less clear that they need honor. How people leave sforim lying around, how people leave their homes, how people leave the Beis HaMedrash, how people behave at the table. Those are things where it's clear that certain kovod is required. And if people don't act with kovod, if they eat with a nose and with a mess, if they leave their sforim lying all over the place, with pages torn out and dirty, if they leave the base of Medrash in chaos with chairs all over the place, These are things they know have to be respected. But how do they treat the man in the street? How do they treat flowers? How do they treat animals? How do they treat minerals, vegetables? How do they treat everything? That's what one has to be aware of. Everything requires cover, and everything needs to be respected. You might ask, why then is there a mitzvah to destroy an idol? Totally, to just grind it up. We don't use it for anything, because that is proving what an idol really is. You take a stone Buddha, what are you doing when you're grinding it up? You're saying, this is stone, that's all, it's mineral, it's sand. That's its true place, that's what it really is. And you grind it up and you make it like sand. That's what it is. To finish off, if one wants to be cynical about matzah, about bread, sorry, one can say bread is nothing but matzah. That's really the truth. Bread is flour and water plus hot air. Take out the hot air because we don't eat it in any case. So bread is nothing but matzah. It's the same thing. Pesach is a warning about cynicism too. Because the fact is that after Pesach, we rush out to buy some bread. We're tired of eating matzah after 1 week. If bread is nothing but matzah, why don't we eat matzah all year? You can't. But it's nothing but matzah. That's what it is. But it's not. Pesach, the whole purpose of Pesach, the whole concept of starting the Seder, the four questions. You analyze, you pull to pieces, you criticize. That's the whole theory of Pesach, starting here from the Korban Pesach. The whole thing is to take things which people are regarding as gods and analyze them down to what they really are. Take bread, chometz, and see that in fact it's nothing but old matzah. That's all it is. But after Pesach, there's another message. Bread is nothing but matzah. One has to be very careful with one's questioning, with one's cynicism. It doesn't become cynicism. But you don't forget that although in essence bread is nothing but matzah, sometimes you have to present the thing as well. Although the leader, the President of the United States, might be nothing but an ordinary man, you've got to isolate him from cynicism. Although a little item which you want to put in a museum is nothing but an ordinary item, you want to preserve it, you've got to put it in a museum. Bread is nothing but matzah. If you want to eat it, you've got to bake it like bread, not like matzah. That's a message that comes right to the Pesach. The analysis to make sure that we know what things really are. But after Pesach, making sure that we know how to present things so as to make them palatable and digestible.